Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of MixerG.com, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And on my second computer right here, I've got an article from CNBC. The headline is, "This 28-year-old company makes millions buying from Walmart and selling on Amazon." I thought that was intriguing. I invited him here to talk about how he did it. But before I got him to talk, we spent about 15 minutes with me saying, "Did you really do it? What did you sell? How do I know you're the real thing? Did you lie to my producer?" And he said, "You know, Andrew, I can't actually within the interview show the store, tell people what we sell, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't. But I could do a screen share if that'll get you off my freaking back." I said, "I don't know if it'll get me off my back, but yes, I do want to do a screen share." So he did a screen share and he showed me the back end of his Amazon store, and we clicked around as he was showing me how much money he made in the last 30 days, how much money he made year to date and last year. I've got a good sense of the business now, and I also promised him that there are certain things I wouldn't say, like what he sold on Amazon. But from everything I could see and everything that CNBC saw, and I know that they did their research, this guy's selling online really well. So I trust him when he says, "I'm also teaching people how to sell on Amazon." So I invited him here to talk about specifically what's working for him, how on Amazon, and how he sold online and how he learned this whole thing. And I think we might get a little bit into his online course, but mostly I want to know about e-commerce today and what's working for someone who's actually doing it. So his name is Ryan Grant. His store is, I'm not allowed to tell you, but we'll talk about it. And the site that he has where he talks about his online selling experiments, including not just how he sells on Amazon, but how he bought a Shopify store and what's working for him there and what's not. The store where you can read up about it. And if you want, learn from him by taking his course. It's called Online Selling Experiments. And this interview where I talked to a guest after spending 15 minutes pushing him and challenging him is sponsored by two great companies. The first will let you do smart email marketing. It's called ActiveCampaign. And the second will help you hire your next phenomenal developer. It's called TopTal. Ryan, good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
2017, how much money did you make selling on Amazon? Revenue
on Amazon, we did about $3.7 million in 2017.
Okay. And I did look at those numbers, so I can confirm that that is true. How much of that is profit, though?
In the ballpark of 10% is the actual take home.
So about $300,000 to $400,000 is what you're getting from Amazon. And then you're also selling online. How much of your business is coming from teaching online?
At this point, about 60% of the actual profits from the business are from the online retail side, actually selling online, and then 40% come from consulting and the online selling experiment side of the business.
So give or take about $250,000 profit from the teaching?
Yeah, it was a little bit less in 2017, but it's in the ballpark.
Okay. And this whole thing started because you went into your college bookstore, and what happened?
Yeah. So my first semester of college, I was a freshman. I bought my books from the bookstore. I didn't know any better. And then at the end of my first semester, I took my books back to the college bookstore to hopefully sell them, get some cash back for them. And the offer that they gave me was almost offensively low, and so low that even as a cash-strapped college student, I was like, I can't sell them to you guys for this. And it led me into looking for some other options to sell those books. And one of those options was Amazon. So I ended up selling my textbooks on Amazon as opposed to selling them back to the college bookstore. I was able to get a lot more money back for them.
Did you do anything that any other college kid wouldn't know? I mean, were you better at copywriting it, at listing it more intelligently? Did you know to ship it to Amazon first or ship it later or do anything different from what an average college kid would do?
Not really.
Not at that point.
Not at that point. I was just, it was just what anybody could do if they have a textbook that they want to sell. I didn't do anything special at that point, but that was my first experience selling an item on Amazon. So that kind of started it all.
So I'm wondering then, why did that excite you? Making a few extra dollars was, your guy who was selling throughout his life, right? You're a kid. You did, what was a pumpkin thing that you sold when you were growing up?
Yeah, when we were growing up on my parents', at my parents' house, they have a hobby farm. We grew up on about 6 acres, and we had some sheep, goats, animals like that, and then we had a few cash crops, if you will. Those were pumpkins and strawberries. So we had pumpkins that we would plant in the spring, and then we'd take care of them all year, and then we'd sell them in the fall around Halloween time.
Do you get to keep the money?
We got a portion. I had to split it with my siblings.
Of the sale. So if you sold more, you got more money.
Exactly.
Did you do something with it?
Honestly, I mean, it wasn't a ton of money. I don't remember exactly what I spent that on. But I do. It was cool to be able to get money without having a job and
kind of
being
in control. Experience. Then as a college kid selling books online, even if you make, let's say, $100 more, $300 more, why did that blow your mind so much that it changed the course of your life?
I think what I saw was the potential of doing it at a larger scale. If you're doing it just with your own books, it's not life-changing if you get an extra $100 or $200. But when you see hundreds or thousands of college kids in line looking to sell their books back for a price that you know is significantly lower than the price that they're going for in another marketplace, I think I saw the potential of being able to pay them a little bit more for their books and then still be able to sell them at the market prices and make nice margins in between. So I think it was the potential for scale that got me excited about it.
And so the next step was that buying their books?
Yep. So then from there, the next semester I sold books for some of my friends and that went well. And then from there, I recruited a friend who was a roommate at the time to help me with this. And our goal was to buy as many books as we could from other students. So we set up a table near the college bookstore at the end of the semester. And then whenever we saw college students walking by with textbooks, we would basically say, "Hey, we're buying books. And we're paying more than the bookstore. We're willing to make you an offer on the spot, or you can go get an offer from the bookstore and then we'll beat it by 10%.
You were sitting down seeing what the prices were going for on Amazon.
Exactly. We would look it up on Amazon, and then there's another site called bookscouter.com, which it has a list of different websites where basically you can send your book to them and then they will send you a check for the book.
All those other places would send you a check for the books. I see.
Exactly.
All right.
So we would pay less than the Book Scouter price, less than we could get an immediate cash offer for. So we'd lock in a little bit of a gain there, and then we'd ultimately most of the time sell it on Amazon, and then we'd be able to make a higher margin selling it on that platform.
Were you being secretive about this? Were you the kind of person who'd say, "I don't want them to know that I was on Amazon"?
No, at that point, we would say what we were doing. We would say we're just selling it online, and for the people that were already in line for the college bookstore, they have a pretty clear buyer intent that they're looking to sell their textbooks for cash. They're not looking to put in that extra time and effort. So our value prop is just that we're going to pay you a little bit more than you're going to get by going to the bookstore. So if they asked where we were selling it, we would say it's Amazon.
And I guess if I were going to sell it in a bookstore, I wouldn't want the pain in the ass of selling it on Amazon. You give me 10% more, take it. This is my career.
Exactly.
This is just a transaction in school. Then you set up a table, you started buying it. Weren't the school administrators or the people in the store pissed that you were doing this?
So right away, it was perfectly fine and we didn't have any issues. The first semester we did it, we actually purchased some books from the college bookstore. They approached us to sell some of their books because they had a program where they would pay $1 for every book that a student brought up, regardless of if it was going to be used in the future. And a lot of those they had no use for. So they actually sold some books to us and buying them for about 12% of whatever they were selling for on Amazon from the bookstore. So right away, they had no issue with us. They actually sold us some books and we worked together.
You bought the $1 books and all those other books that they couldn't sell, you bought for 12 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, 12 cents on 12% of what you could sell for on Amazon. All right, so I could see how things were now starting to take off. At what point did you say, "I got to go beyond this"?
Well, it didn't quite continue to play out quite that nicely. We did still scale up from there, but after we'd seen success on the being able to buy textbooks from students and sell them at the end of the semester, we also wanted to be involved on the transaction when students were buying their books at the beginning of the semester too. So we put together a website specific for, I went to Winona State University in Southeast Minnesota. So we had a site called WinonaTextbooks.com. That basically was a copy of the students or of the school bookstore. It was basically you select your class, your professor, And then the book would display on our website, except it was from Amazon as opposed to from the college bookstore. And then for any student that bought a book through that, we were part of the Amazon affiliate program, Amazon Associates. And then we would get a commission for anything that we sold.
But how did you get that list? The list of books by professor?
That was part of the problem. Because we had initially sourced the information from the college bookstore. And then that kind of was the problem. So shortly after our site went live, we'd started to get a little bit of traction on campus. We got emails from the more or less the compliance department of the university and had to go in and talk to them as well as the college bookstore people. And that site pretty quickly got shut down. They wanted us to basically have to gather all of the data on our own. They weren't willing to work with us. And then that also ruined things at the end of the semester too. We weren't able to buy books on campus. We tried, but the first back at the end of the next semester to go and buy books, we were escorted out by the manager of the common area that was down there.
I went to NYU, and right next to NYU in Greenwich Village, New York, was what was it called? A Shakespeare and Company bookstore. And they wanted to do something similar. They wanted to sell books at a lower price to students who are just a block away going to NYU, a block away from the bookstore. And what they did was they came to me and other students who were pissed at the prices that the bookstore was charging. And they said, can you give us your syllabus, your list of required books? And they started to amass it. And I could see that it was such a pain in the butt for them to do that they finally just gave up on it and decided to sell to tourists.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be a huge, huge undertaking to do that.
I'm looking at your site right now, dude. This was a pretty huge undertaking too. How did you populate the site with all the books? Every page here seems to be a straight up HTML site, straight up HTML page.
Are you on like an archives version of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. We used, I believe the tool we used at the time, it was called Associate-O-Matic. It was basically a plugin of sorts. I don't even know if it was WordPress, but basically you were able to put in the UPC for the product and then it would pick which location you wanted it in. And then it would display on the web page. So it took a long time to put that site together.
But it wasn't being put together programmatically, right? It was someone manually arranging it, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yep. We were manually doing it.
Yeah. So that's just a nightmare. But every course is listed on the left margin. If I click on one of the courses, let me click on, where was this? I clicked on music. All the books are there displayed nicely. And they all link to Amazon. All right. So sucks that didn't work out. You ended up becoming an accountant. Doing what specifically? Or working for an accounting agency. What'd you do?
Yeah. So once I graduated from college, I worked for McGladrey as an audit associate, or an assurance associate was my official title. But basically, I was working on financial statement audits for manufacturing and distribution companies.
Okay. So at that point, did you start selling online?
Yeah, I was still selling online on the side.
Books?
At this point, when I'd graduated from college, we doing this textbook thing on the side still, and we'd expanded to doing it at about 4 days around Southeast Minnesota.
Sorry, I just lost what you said. You expanded to doing what?
Oh, we were buying textbooks at the end of semesters. We were doing that at 4 different campuses around Minnesota. So that was still going on the side. And then, yeah, that was the main thing that I was doing when I first started the job, and I did that on the side throughout the job. And then from there, after working in the accounting job for the first 3 to 6 months, I realized it wasn't the path I wanted to be on. And then I started looking into ways that I could sell other products too, and start to find things that would sell year round as opposed to textbooks, which are very seasonal. So when I first started off, it was a lot of like toys, games, gift type items, groceries, really anything that I could find that made sense to sell. When I was first getting started, then it was a lot of what's known as retail arbitrage, which is buying items on clearance and discounts at local retail stores and then turning around and selling that on Amazon. So just about anything that I could find on clearance, that's the type of thing that I would turn around and sell. So if you see it on a clearance aisle in a Walmart, Target, Toys R Us, not a Toys R Us anymore, but a store like that, then it's pretty likely that I've sold something like that in the past.
You go into the store, you'd see it on clearance, you'd look it up on your phone to see what it was going for on Amazon, and if it was the right spread, you would buy it.
Exactly.
What kind of spread were you looking for?
I wanted to see at least a 50% investment. So if I was, after all fees, all shipping, if I was spending $10 on the item, I wanted to get paid at least 15, and then I'd make a profit of $5, which
would
give me that 50%.
Were you shipping it out of your house at the time?
I was using the Fulfillment by Amazon program, and I was, everything came into the house, and then I would box it up, ship it to Amazon's warehouses. So yeah, it was all in my house at the time.
But at least when you're doing that, you can take 10, 20 different products, put it in one box and let them sort it out, right?
Exactly.
You're
yeah.
Not so that individually that boxing things.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That is a lot of work though. Are there a couple of products that you're especially proud of from back then?
I never got too attached to the actual products. I just saw it as sort of a commodity where it's something that I could make money on. From back in the day, some of the big items I did really well with were Frozen was huge about 3 years ago. Those Elsa and Anna dolls, did really well with a lot of those. They were going for above retail prices on Amazon. I remember a really big haul of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles toys. Target had a huge, they marked them down and then they did like a buy one, get one 50% off sale that was just huge. So probably bought like $5,000 of those toys over the course of a weekend and they all sold within a month or two.
I got a little upset with my iPhone because it couldn't do things like multitask in real time. I couldn't watch a video while browsing the web mindlessly for a while. And so I bought a Pixel and then I discovered the AirBuds and I love the AirBuds so much that I decided I can't go to the Pixel. I have to stay in Apple's ecosystem. The Pixel phone was still in its brand new box. I said, I'm going to sell it on Amazon. I shipped it over. I accidentally listed it as a Pixel XL instead of a Pixel. Somebody bought it. Gotcha. Said, I've got to return it. And she's going to return it. I'm going to resell it. But because she returned it, it's a pain in the butt for me. And because she returned it, now it's an open box, which means it loses some of its value. So this whole idea of you selling it and then it moves on is nice in theory, but often you end up with returns where people ruin the product or they reduce the cost of the product. And regardless of what happens, you have to deal with shipping back and forth. So how much of your margin was eaten up by people who are returning and opening the boxes and returning?
Yeah, that's a good question. It definitely happens.
It's a long-winded question too.
What's that?
I went really long with that question. I thought I'd add a little color to this. And right. Instead, it was like a lot of wind. Okay. So yeah, how do you deal with that?
A little bit on what categories you're selling in. So if you're selling like toys and games, that's a lower return rate as compared to like an apparel, clothing and shoes have a much higher return rate. If you're selling like general home goods, I saw a normal return rate of about 2-3% on most orders. If you're selling in the apparel type categories, it's most likely going to be in the 10-15% range. So at scale, it doesn't matter much. Like if you're selling one item and it gets returned, obviously that's a very frustrating thing. But if you sold 100 of them, odds are two or three are going to get returned. So what we do is anytime we get a return like that, it comes back to our warehouse. And then we have a process to either get it sold back on Amazon, or if it can't go there, then if there's something wrong with it, it needs pictures, then it'll go on eBay. And that's where anything that needs descriptions or specific pictures of it, then we'll list it on eBay. Most of the time we're able to at least recoup our costs in the event of a used product. So in like your Pixel example, maybe if you bought it from a distributor, you'd probably pay 50-60% of retail. You'd initially sell it for 100% of retail, it gets returned, and then you have to sell it as used like new, or used open box. You still most likely can sell it in that 60-70% of retail price point, and then you recouped at least your initial investment. So from my experience, the downside is relatively low. It's pretty rare that they throw away things entirely or the customers ruin it that bad. So returns in the online retail space are kind of a fact of life. And as long as you maintain
quite an operation, though, you're saying even back then when you were doing this from home, stuff would come back to your house. You would decide what to do with it. Was it you personally taking pictures and listing it on eBay at the time?
At the time, yeah.
Wow. All right. We'll talk about how you expanded from there and how you even got to CNBC in a moment. First, let me talk about a company called Toptal. Have you ever worked with Toptal?
I have not, no.
You know what? I talk about them a lot, and I know a lot of people are curious about them and they're not sure what it's like. So I thought instead of me telling about my listeners' experience, I'll tell you one thing that I read on Quora. There's a poster on Quora, a guy who asked a question who said, what's it like to work with TopTal from the perspective of a company that's hiring a TopTal engineer? And this guy, Doug McKay, responded. And here's in a nutshell what Doug said. He said that he worked with TopTal to get mobile app design and user experience put together because he wanted to create his app. He said once the thing was done, he went to TopTal and he hired, since they don't just do developers, they also have finance people. He went to TopTal's finance department. He said, hey, do you have someone who could help me organize my data because I've got to go talk to venture capitalists? He got that. As a result of the help that he got from them, 6 venture capitalists were interested in his company. And so the return on investment of having somebody actually help him with his finances, help him think through his pitch deck, and somebody who has experience to do that was incredibly helpful. And then he said, I went to hire developers to help me out. I went cheap. I went to look at one of these freelance sites because they were a fourth the cost of TopTal. And I looked at it and he realized, you know what? The results were also pretty crappy, much, much worse than going with TopTal. So he said, fine, I'm going to actually hire from TopTal. And he did. So from top to bottom, TopTal helped him. First, user experience and app design, which is TopTal's designer group. Then pitch help, which is TopTal's finance group. And then finally, what TopTal is most known for, helping companies find phenomenal developers, came from TopTal's developer group. So anyone out there who's listening to me, who's heard me talk about TopTal for hiring developers, and frankly, you might need them at some point too, Ryan, they're phenomenal at that. But as you could see from Doug and so many other people's experiences, TopTal now has designers that are great and finance people who are incredibly helpful. So if you're listening to me and you want to hire from them, don't just go to TopTal.com. Go to the special URL I'm about to give you where they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. That URL is toptal.com/mixergy. Top is in top of your head. Tal is in talent. toptal.com/mixergy. TOPTAL.com/mixergy. You then got to, you know what? Actually, let's talk about this promotional. I feel like you're really good at promoting yourself. Subtle, charming, like it doesn't feel heavy-handed and still freaking good. How did you get to CNBC?
Yeah, so CNBC, that all came from a Reddit AMA that I did. That was the primary catalyst for doing that. I did an AMA back in, it was probably October or November, in the Entrepreneur subreddit. And then that got a lot of engagement. I was talking about how my business at that point, we'd done about 2.2 million year to date in 2017 at the time I did that. And a lot of questions came in and it got a lot of exposure.
This is my business has sold $2.29 million on Amazon so far in 2017. Ask me anything. And then you kind of detailed it. And they at CNBC read that?
Yep. So a team from CNBC saw that and then they reached out to me directly and I with Zach Guzman, who was the reporter who did the story. So he did an initial call with me to learn more. And then he pitched the idea to his team. We went back and forth. I had to provide a little bit of proof to verify.
I saw that actually. I really respected that article a lot and it carried a lot of weight with me because I forget where, but several times in the article that they did to accompany the video, they talked about how they did, that they did research on you. Like they looked at the receipts from your Walmart experience, for example, right?
Yeah, they checked. I shared some of the items that I sold specifically with them. I did like an export of some sales history from when I was first getting started. So yeah, they did. They definitely did their due diligence.
And still, before this interview started, I said, tell me what your Amazon story is. You said, I'd rather not. I said, okay, I understand. Actually, I don't understand. Why wouldn't you want to show it to the audience? And you talked about it. And then you also said, I won't even show you. I'd rather not show you, actually. You were pretty nice about it. I got the sense that if I pushed you a little bit that you would go for it. But there was some hesitation there that I want to understand. Why do you hesitate showing it? And did you show it to CNBC?
So I didn't show it to CNBC either.
You didn't
either. Not the specific store. We did a similar screen share and showed them specific screenshots. They got a copy of the 1099 from Amazon as well to go one step further. But in terms of like why I don't want that out there, certain suppliers we have don't necessarily want to be associated directly with everything, all aspects of the business, maybe the online selling experiment side, they don't want their brand necessarily involved with that. And then on the retail arbitrage side of things, which is still a component of my business, we don't want to share the exact products that we're selling. We're willing to share some of the strategies because there's differences in different geographic regions. But if exact store, then anybody can see exactly which items they are, try to get those items in their stores. And it just creates a little bit of unneeded exposure or competition on some of those products for us.
All right. That's interesting that you didn't show it to them. We can say that it's, you asked me not to say specifically even what kind of apparel, but you said you can say it's apparel that I showed you, the apparel store.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How'd you focus in on apparel?
Yeah, we got started there as it's an angle that wasn't it. Well, there's a few reasons. One is it's a higher price point on each product that we sell. There's challenges that come with that category. Like shoes, for example, sell through relatively slowly compared to other categories. You also stock a lot of inventory, so it's fairly capital intensive.
Well, you have to stock with apparel a lot of inventory? Uh-huh.
Yep, because there's different sizes. It's not like you're selling just a copy of the board game Monopoly. If you're going to stock shoes, you need sizes 6 through 12 or whatever size run you want to carry. So it's a lot more capital intensive. There's, in my opinion, a little bit less competition. It's a higher return rate, which creates challenges people aren't willing to deal with. And it's also a category that requires an additional level.
Boy, I don't know why the connection's kind of flaky. What is it?
Okay. It's a category that requires an additional level of approval from Amazon. So that's creates an additional barrier to entry. So that's been one of the reasons we focused there. Category part of the year. Depending on which time of the year you see which categories we're selling on, it's going to vary a bit too. So apparel is consistent year round for us. But if we come to the end of the year where Christmas, people are buying things for gifts, toys, and some of the household categories would be a lot higher on our list because of what we're selling at the time. So we adjust our sourcing a little bit over the course of the year based on what's most in demand.
You know, one of my favorite questions that our producers ask guests before we start is, what's one question that I didn't think to ask that we should ask you? And your response was, you guys should probably go deeper on the twists and turns of the early online selling days. So what are they? So far, it seems like a really natural, easy transition from one step to the next. Talk to me about what some of those twists were. What are the challenges?
Yeah, there were definitely some challenges along the way. One of the biggest ones was probably having my Amazon account suspended. So in I believe this was the summer of 2015, there was a product that I was selling. It was called the Pedicure Power. It's like a nail filing tool for dogs. We bought a liquidation lot of these and it turned out that some of them were defective and customers were getting them and they weren't working properly. And it caused enough of them were returned that Amazon basically stopped us from being able to sell that particular item. And then it led to the actual suspended, which is Amazon's punishment, if you will. But all your items stop being for sale and you don't get paid. They hold on to your money. And then basically you have to put together an appeal to get back and get reinstated and reactivate your listings, to get paid and continue to sell. So I was able to get reinstated.
How long did it take you?
In this case, it wasn't very long. I was back within about 2 days, but I had known some other people who have been suspended and it's taken 3 to 4 weeks to get back. We knew how to put together the appeal in the way that Amazon would be likely to respond to it and knew what information to include on the front end. So that helped a lot in terms of getting it taken quickly, but that's not everybody's experience. So I think I was a little bit lucky in the time frame that they were able to look at it too, because it definitely takes a lot longer for some people.
You know, I saw that you've written about this on your site a couple of times. It seems like it must have been for the 2 days really painful, but as big challenges go, that's not the worst. It's not so painful, is it?
It was scary. I mean, when you have to send a text to like an employee and be like, okay, we're not working today because the account is in jeopardy, that really makes you take a step back and think about, okay, what do I need to add to this business, or am I on the right path? And it makes you reevaluate the risk reward of decisions and things like that. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely worse bumps that could come up along the way, but that was a pretty scary one at the time, as Amazon was the biggest driver of the revenue for my business then.
And all right. And I could see how even the other sources of revenue were still dependent on that.
Exactly.
So you got back on. Were there other challenges, or was that the big one, the only one?
That was a big one. No other huge ones really come to mind. I mean, building a team and figuring out how to manage people and do that in a cohesive manner is definitely challenges that come up there. But I don't know. I've learned some things in terms of like contracts and getting a lawyer involved when reviewing agreements. But yeah, I mean, I think I've been pretty fortunate to avoid some things that could have go worse than they
have
for me.
Let's talk about hiring. At first it was you. Then you mm-hmm. started using the word we, and you explained that it was you and your roommate. The roommate was a co-owner in the business?
He was of the textbook, in the textbook days.
So all those sites that you created, you guys co-owned, but once you were done with that, he moved on his separate, you guys moved to your separate ways.
Exactly.
And then when you started selling, you started doing everything yourself, going to the stores, listing, et cetera. What's the first person you hired?
Yeah, so the first person that I hired was someone to help me buy via retail arbitrage. So someone else to go into stores and help source products. That was the first role that I brought people on for, just because.
And you gave them specific set of rules. Go to the store, look for these types of things, look for this margin. Okay. And
exactly.
Did that work out okay early on, or were there some issues there?
No, that worked out. That worked out pretty well. The initial way that I did that setup was paying them a percentage of the profits once the item sold. Okay. That was messy from an accounting perspective. So that's not a model that I use anymore. But outside of that, the actual setup of having people conduct retail arbitrage, that worked very well. And it's something we still do in the business today.
All right. And then what was the next set of hires?
Yep. And then from there, it was basically hiring some additional shipping and prep help to be able to get the inventory out the door. With more people buying led to more inventory. And then it's been a very consistent progression from there to make sure that you can get the inventory out the door. It's like, as soon as I have capital to buy more inventory, I would hire support to be able to buy more inventory. And then once we're buying more than we're able to ship out, then I would add in prep help to be able to get that inventory out the door.
When'd you get a warehouse?
The first warehouse that I had was about 735 square feet. I moved into that in September of 2014. So that was a year after I was full time in the business.
And then you somewhere around there also bought a duplex. I read your post about that.
Yeah.
I read that you said $138,000 is what you paid for it. And I'm thinking, San Francisco, that's not even nearly a down payment. Where do you get a duplex for that much money?
$139,000 was the purchase price back in March of 2013. This is in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis. You get a duplex for that much, start bringing in rent. Uh-huh.
You do then. The market's changed quite a bit since then. There's still, if you go further outside the city in some of the suburbs, you can still get a duplex in that price range. It's not in a very desirable area at this point. But yeah, I actually bought the duplex before I quit my accounting job, while I still had the W-2 income that the banks like to see. Right. So that was one of the things I wanted to make sure I had in place before I quit the job. Bought the duplex, I live in half, and then I rented out the other. And basically, since the entire time that I've owned it, it's been rented out. And the rent that I get from the other half of the duplex covers the monthly mortgage payment. So I've basically been living for free for the past 5 years.
And you're still in the same place?
I have actually just sold it, and the sale closes. It's set to close in a couple weeks.
For how much?
A lot more.
Multiple times what you paid. Multiple times the sale price.
It's at least double.
Okay. Wow. You know, by the way, I'm still like hunting you down as we're talking. If you see my eyes go everywhere, it's because I'm using domaintools.com to look up your domain, spyonweb.com to look to see what other domain. But you're hosting with Google, right? Your website?
My website, Online Selling Experiment, is hosted through WP Engine.
WP Engine. Oh, but the domain then maybe is, I can't find anything. I thought I had something. I said, I think I know what he's selling online. And then it was someone else's site.
gotcha.
All right. Let's continue then with the story. So you're continuing to hire. It seems like you're constantly hiring people to do things for you instead of helping you think through the business. Am I right?
Yes, that's been the path that I've taken so far for the most part.
Even the Shopify store that you bought, that's one of your latest experiments. Mm-hmm. The person who's working on it with you is an intern. They're here to learn from you. You're guiding them, telling them what to do. They're picking up knowledge as they do it. Why is that? Why are you hiring people just to do your process, to do what you're guiding them to do, instead of hiring higher level people who could teach you more?
Yeah. So there's a couple angles to that. For the most part, like with the hiring I've done, especially the initial hires, was I would want to figure it out myself, put a process in place, and then outsource it, because then I'd be able to support them in doing that. And that's worked well for me. So that's part of the reason that I've stuck with that strategy. When it comes to like the online selling experiment side of the business, I've hired a specific copywriter. I have somebody who helps specifically with the SEO side of things. So in that, when it's a more specialized task, something I don't have as much knowledge in, that's when I look to hire someone
and just bring them in to do that.
A set of skills that I don't have.
Okay.
Yep. Something where I feel like I have a good strategy, or at least a good outline for a strategy. And the Shopify store is a good example of this. I have something that I believe will work. I don't necessarily want to be the one that has to put in the time to execute upon the strategy, but I want to more or less put the game plan in place, let them run with the game plan, and then see how it goes. And if it works, great. If it doesn't, at that point, that's when I'd look to get a specific expert involved from there.
All right. I want to know how you sell on Amazon in a moment, what's working for you, how you figure out what to sell, how you list it that's different as much as we can. First, I've got to tell, I think I'm going to tell you for the first time about ActiveCampaign. Have you ever used them?
I have not, no.
Let me give you an example of how ActiveCampaign could work. You write about eBay, Shopify, Amazon. I think you even do a little bit about your own personal story on your site. Your posts are super well tagged and you're clicking from one to the other. What I don't think you do, at least for my spying, I couldn't find this. You don't notice that if I'm reading constantly the Shopify articles, which at this point I'm fascinated by Shopify, you're not tagging me as a Shopify interested person. Imagine if you were. If you were to say, Andrew just keeps clicking on every Shopify thing. He has clicked on one or two eBay articles or Amazon article, but Shopify, every time I post, he clicks it. I should send him an offer to do coaching with me for Shopify stores. Or I don't have a course right now, but let's test the waters for a course. I'll find an affiliate program and email him about Shopify stores to see if he'll buy that. And if he and people like him do, then maybe we create a course for Shopify. Or let's send him a link to a tool for Shopify that would be helpful. And if he's clicking it and buying it, we'll make an affiliate commission. But more importantly, we'll know that everyone in our audience who reads a lot of articles on Shopify is open to buying these tools. Maybe we should create tools. So that kind of technology is pretty intense. Do you do anything like that now?
Not on the actual web page.
You do it via email clicks.
Set up in my email system, but yeah, in terms of how people are interacting with the online
selling experiment. What do you do via email clicks?
Gauge interest for different things and track which links people are clicking on. And then based on what they click on, they can get put into different sequences.
What are some of your sequences?
What's that?
What are some of your sequences in your email?
The main one at this point is getting started selling on Amazon. And then there's one for, I'm going to be launching a new membership site soon. So I've been mentioning things about that. And if people click on that, and I've been collecting tags on if people are interested in like retail arbitrage, online arbitrage, wholesale, which are all different methods of sourcing on Amazon. And then maybe there will be offers at some point in the future, but it's a way to gauge what people are likely to be interested in the future. And then another one we collect is what experience level people are at. So if they're just getting started on Amazon, if they're selling $1,000 per month on Amazon, or if they're above $10,000. Why?
Okay, that makes total sense. And that is the kind of stuff that you want to ask people about. And email is probably the best way. Well, email and forms on your site, surveys are useful for that. The thing is that most of us are doing that. It's a pain in the butt with a lot of software to do it, but most of us are at least tagging what people are clicking on. We notice segment based on that. Most software makes it a pain in the butt. ActiveCampaign makes it super simple. In fact, if you go to their site, the URL that I'm about to give, you can see they've got these gifts to show you exactly how to do that. The on-site stuff, we don't do enough. Meanwhile, on-site is where people tell us a ton about themselves. What are they clicking on? What videos are they watching all the way to the end? What do they keep coming back to? What topics? And so what ActiveCampaign decided to do was make that super simple so that more businesses could actually do that. They give you a little snippet of code. You put it throughout your site. And once you do, you can say this page means that they're paying attention to this topic. Let's tag them as that. If they have enough of those tags, let's sell them that way. That's what ActiveCampaign does. So they let you tag people based on what they do on your site, what they do in your email, let you message them via email. Or more and more people are saying, I don't just want to message people via email. There's some things like if you do a Facebook, I think you did a Facebook Live, didn't you? Where you were doing an AMA. Did you do an AMA on live?
I might have a long time ago. Yeah, not recently.
Okay. Well, if you do something like that or even a Reddit AMA, sometimes it's good to say, I need everybody to show up right now. And there's nothing like a text message to get them to show up right now for webinars, for Facebook Lives, et cetera. And ActiveCampaign natively will enable you to do that. So if you or anyone else is looking to do deep, smart marketing automation that's super simple, so simple that they show you on their site the back end to show you how easy it is, I urge you to go check out activecampaign.com/Mixergy. And the reason that you want to put that /Mixergy at the end is, first of all, you'll be helping out your friend Andrew. And second, what you're going to get is they're going to migrate you from whatever other software you have. They'll migrate you for free. So if you're using a stupid competitor, which doesn't do this type of marketing automation, or even a brilliant one that does it but makes it too complicated, they'll move you over for free if you use this URL. They'll also let you try their software out for free. So maybe one night, do you drink whiskey, wine, something else?
I don't drink too much. When I do, usually beer.
Beer. So maybe one night you're just cracking open a beer, watching something on Netflix, and you try them for free. You get a sense of it and you go, this actually could be good. Maybe not for my whole business yet because I'm not ready to do it, but there's this new idea I have. I'm going to put it on ActiveCampaign. And when it's free, you can do that. Second month for free after you pay, and 2 free one-on-one sessions. And already this ad went too long, so I'm going to end it by saying, go to activecampaign.com/Mixergy. activecampaign.com/Mixergy. You know, Satya, the guy who sells ads for us, said, Andrew, I've been noticing you go really long with the ads. I say, yeah, I've got to cut it back. He goes, yeah, because in my agreement with sponsors, I tell them Andrew will talk for 30 to 60 seconds. And then he goes, look, it's like 5 minutes sometimes.
That's a good deal for the sponsor.
Yeah, great for the sponsor. Hopefully it's useful for the audience. I'd love it if my audience told me if it wasn't, if I was going too long. Guys, if I'm yapping too much, andrew@mixergy.com, let me know. All right. Where do you get the ideas for what products to sell? What tools are you using to figure that out?
Yeah. So we use, it depends on a little bit on which sourcing method we're using. But if we take retail arbitrage, the main thing that we're using is a scanning app.
It's a what? So there's app? Scanning app? Sorry.
Scanning app. Yep.
Oh, just to scan to see what it's selling for on Amazon?
Exactly.
What app do you use for that?
The Amazon seller app is one that's free. It's a good one to get started with. The one we're currently using is called Scoutify. It's made by a company called Inventory Lab. And basically what these apps do is it lets you take your phone, you point your phone's camera at the barcode on a product, and then it's going to show you all the different about how well the product's selling on Amazon, how much it's selling for, and it gives you enough information to make a decision if it makes sense to buy that item to sell on Amazon or not.
I see that at inventorylab.com/solutions.html, but it's in there. All right. Once you're still using this, you're still going out and doing arbitrage on clothes?
We do it on some products. We do it more on like general products. So things like toys, gift type items, home improvement items. We do a little bit of apparel and shoes mixed in there too. Yep. So that's still a portion of the business. So the outsourced retail arbitrage. So I have buyers that go out to the stores and do this for me. And then another big piece of our business is what we call wholesale sourcing. So that's buying from manufacturers and distributors of existing brands. And then we'll basically partner with them, buy products from them at their wholesale prices as if they were selling to like a brick and mortar retailer. And then we'll do the online distribution for them. We'll sell it on Amazon, eBay, Jet.com, our own websites, wherever they want it sold on the distribution channels that we offer. Then we'll put it for sale for them and basically manage that into the process.
And then you at that point aren't taking much risk because they're telling you where to sell it and you don't pay unless it's sold, right?
You don't pay when we receive the product. So we do a pretty deep investigation into all the products before we purchase them. And then we'll gauge demand as best we can before purchasing them. And usually we'll start off with some test orders to see how well things sell. And then based on those initial orders and how things sell through, that's what we gauge our future reorders on. So we do pay for the product that we're bringing in.
How do you know? What kind of signals are you looking to tell you that something's worth testing?
Yeah. So the main three pieces are, first, the return on investment. How much money are we going to make on it? The second piece is what we call, what's known as a sales rank. That's a piece of information specific to Amazon, and it's an indication of how long it's been since the item is last sold. So if an item has a sales rank of one, it's the most recent item that's sold in a specific category. So that's another very helpful piece. And then the number of reviews that the product has is very helpful for determining how often people are buying it. So the sales rank in combination with reviews gives you a lot of information about how quickly the product is selling. And then we couple that with the return on investment. And the faster the item is selling, the lower that we're willing to go on the return on investment scale. If we think it's a little bit slower selling, then we're going to be more likely to require a higher return on investment to sell those particular products.
And you're using the sales rank directly from Amazon. I just did a search to try something out. There's something mm-hmm. called pull-up assist bands. I don't know what that is, but it's the first thing that I clicked on when I went to Amazon. And their Amazon bestsellers rank is 194 in sports and outdoors. That's what you would do, or using a tool to get that data out?
Yep. So we use a tool. We use a tool for that. It's called Price Checker 2 on the wholesale side. Basically, we can upload a list of prices and UPCs, and then the software is going to give us an output that has the sales rank. It'll run the return figures. It factors in all of the Amazon fees. It'll look at the reviews and things like that.
How does it know the return figures?
What's that?
How does it know what the return figures are for that?
Return on investment, not actual return percentages.
This is from dailysourcetools.com. Is that the tool?
I believe that's the company who puts it out. Yeah.
Okay. So you're getting all that. You then run a small test to get a sense of how well it'll sell. Do you look at comparables, other products that are similar too?
Yep. I mean, basically anytime we find a winner, anytime we find something that we can buy, we're going to look at what other products are similar to it, what other products that manufacturer distributor carries, and we just branch out from there. So anytime we find something that works, we're going to take that as many different angles as we can to find more similar products or in that same umbrella to carry as many products.
All right. Now you've got the product, you want ready to test. Do you do anything different about the photos, the design, the listing, the search engine optimization within Amazon?
For the most part, a lot of the products we sell are initially, they'll have a listing on there. We do make sure that the listings are we have at least, we want 6 images that are quality, show the product, that they're clickable and able to zoom in on the products. We want to make sure the bullet points are filled out, contain search terms. We want to make sure all the back end things are in place. We'll set them up so that they run in our PPC. We run ads through Amazon system. About all the products we launch initially. So that allows us to gather additional data mm-hmm. and it helps to sell through faster too. So we'll set them up in that system. And yeah, so we'll go through, make sure the listing's optimized, set up the ads. And then at that point, we're pretty much ready to start the initial test and see how they sell.
Do you work with a copywriter on that?
At the moment, no, we do that in-house. But that's something considering for the future.
And is that something that you also put together a checklist for and then the team goes and writes it, or someone else did that?
For that particular process, that's more or less, that's been done by the members at this point. So I had a version that I was using, but that's been tweaked and optimized by the team over time.
Okay. Seems like you're a big systems and checklist person, am I right?
Yeah. I mean, I try to put a process in place so that there's a game plan to follow. Because if I can get a result doing something, if I can put a system in place or a process in place, then I can have somebody else do that, get that same result, and then I can work on something else and kind of continue having that run while focusing on growing another aspect of the business.
You know, so we're big on that too at my company, at Mixergy. The problem we had for a long time was we'd have a system and then it would just work and we'd never improve it. And we finally did something that helped, which is put together a checklist with deadlines to check on the big processes that we have, like the pre-interview process that you went through. There mm-hmm. is a reminder to check on it every 3 months. And after you did your pre-interview, we went in and we overhauled it and adjusted it. And now we're going to go back in another few weeks and adjust it again. That helped us. Do you have any tips like that for improving a process? Because it's so easy to set up a process, know it works, and then disappear on it because it works.
Yeah, I like that idea that you just mentioned there of having a regular interval to follow up on it. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't have a great answer for that. We are tracking the outputs of any process that we have. So we'll have, if it's a process for like retail arbitrage buying, we're going to be tracking the return on investment percentage by individual buyer, by individual store, things like that. And anytime we identify an error in there, basically when we, with the analysis, we're looking for two things: things that are doing really well that we can do more of, and things that aren't doing very well that we need to tweak, change, or adjust.
But it's the numbers that are telling you. You keep looking to see. And then since you have so many numbers, so many different products, so many different product categories, so many different buyers, how do you make sense of it? Is there one spreadsheet that gives you the numbers that are important or something else?
Yeah, we've got there's kind of like one main spreadsheet for different aspects of the business. So for like the Amazon side of the business, we've got one spreadsheet that tracks mainly return on investment by brand, profit by brand, profit by store, profit by category. We track all of those different things over time. And then for some of the other projects, we have like one main spreadsheet. So there's probably three main spreadsheets where I'm tracking these things on a regular basis.
All right, let's talk about Shopify. I saw your experiment with Shopify. I freaking hate that you're not giving the name of the company that you bought, but you bought a company, what was it, on Flippa or on exchange.shopify.com? Where was it?
Yeah, I bought it on Flippa. And the reason I'm not giving the name for that site is because I don't want people to think that the reason that site is successful is because it has my name behind it. And I'm like, if I do an interview like this, I can get the name out of it, name out there. So I want to organic way to show
I totally get that. I think that makes for a better case study, and you do show the back end of it, but man, I just love to see what you're doing. But the problem is that you're doing a long-term test that month after month you're checking in on it. If you just wanted to do a quick test, you'd put the thing up and then I think one of my past guests did it for like 7 days to show how fast it is to get some sales, but it wasn't as deep as your test. All right, but I get it. Let's talk about Shopify, because I get solicited a lot by people who say that they make $2-3 million selling online. What I've learned to do is investigate. They will send me their personal Shopify site. But the more I investigate, the more I realize that the majority of their sales are coming from Amazon. Low margins. You're getting 10% margins. They're getting much less than that. They're barely eking a profit, and their Shopify store is getting hardly any customers. And that's disappointing for them, because at any point their Amazon business could be taken away by someone who's selling a knockoff product, and their Shopify store, it means a connection to the audience and to their customer base, but it's not working. So what have you learned about selling on Shopify that we can pass on to them?
Yeah, so with Shopify, this project is one we've really started taking seriously over the past 5 months, I would say. Honestly, one of the biggest things that's been working for us lately has been working with existing brick and mortar retailers to carry the product. I don't think a lot of people are necessarily approaching them to get their products in the store. But that's been working really well for us, and we've been getting repeat business.
Wait, from going to retail stores and saying, sell my product that I'm selling online?
Exactly. So we're selling it online too, and that's working. I don't think we're doing anything super crazy in that regard just yet. But what we've been getting the most traction on is actually approaching brick and mortar stores to sell our product in their stores, and we'll sell it at wholesale prices to them, and then they'll turn around and sell it to their customers.
So you're selling some unique product, and then you're going to the stores and selling it to them. And what's your process for selling that?
We don't physically go to the stores, but basically we have a team of four virtual assistants who are researching stores to find prospects. And then we have the main guy on my team who's working on this project. We're using a software called woodpecker.co to automatically send these emails, and it personalizes them. It'll automate a follow-up if they don't respond. And then we're just every day we're doing outreach like that. And that's been starting to get some really good results. We've been seeing some reorders already from some of these existing clients. And yeah, I'm pretty excited about where that's going. And our margins on the wholesale side are over 100% as well. So whether we sell it at wholesale or retail doesn't matter to me. And the wholesale side, we get a much larger purchases.
What's your criteria for finding stores to sell to?
We're looking for a specific niche. Like for us, it tends to be more like gift shops. But we go a little bit deeper than that. We basically want somebody that's selling similar products, but doesn't have the particular
niche. So what you'll do is you find these stores. How do you find their email addresses and the right buyers?
Some of the time we've got a few places we check. Most of it's through Google and having the virtual assistants. If they find a potential prospect, if they find a store that makes sense, they'll look on their website for contact emails. They'll search on LinkedIn. They'll search on Yelp. They'll search on their Facebook page. Wherever there might be contact information listed, they'll go to places. And then in a perfect world, we're looking for the email address of the owner or a buyer for the store. But if we can't find that, if they can't find that within about 5 to 10 minutes, I forget what we put in the guide, then they'll just use a generic email for the store, the generic contact email or a contact form.
Okay. So it's very manual and it's your team internally that's finding all this contact info.
Yeah. And that's with virtual assistants. So those are hired through onlinejobs.ph. So it's overseas virtual
searching all
doing
these
that.
Sites onlinejobs.ph. Yeah. I've heard really good things about them. That's hiring virtual assistants in the Philippines, inexpensive, diligent people. That's what you end up getting there. And you hire them full time.
Yep. Those four are full time working. English is a primary language of the Philippines. So there's almost no language barrier, which is one of the big reasons to go there too.
That's interesting. So you acquired the company from Philippa. They sold something that was unique. You said you didn't do enough due diligence. You probably should have done more. But frankly, if you would have done more, you also said you would have, you probably would have bought it anyway. You're selling it online. It seems like Facebook ads were working for you for selling to individuals. Did you do anything else like SEO?
We're just getting started in some SEO strategies and getting some links built. We have some Facebook ads that are working. We've got retargeting ads set up. Those have been converting pretty well. We're running some Google ads. Those haven't been performing quite as well for us so far. But we've got certain search terms that are generating profitable return on ad spend. So we're kind of putting that in maintenance mode is kind of what I'd call it. We've tested a bunch of things. We found a few that work. So we're letting those continue to run. And then we're starting to do more outreach for the consumer side.
And so then you said, here's a category of stores that we want to sell to. Let's see if we can find a way to get as many of those stores in a list as possible. Then the next step is to find their contact info. Then you guys use, what's the name of that software? Use woodpecker.co to automate the emails that go out. The emails look like they come from this guy on your team who works for you. Is he a full-time person?
He is full-time.
Yep. It's customized. If they don't respond, there's another follow-up that says, hey, you might have missed my message or something automated like that. Then when they do respond, he jumps in. He talks to them probably on the phone and sells.
Yep. Either on the phone or email. And then sometimes we'll send the price, the purchase price of each product. We retail most of them between like $30 and $60, but our lower end products only cost us $7 to make. So we'll sometimes send a sample to people as well. So basically the close happens via email or a phone call. In a lot of cases, we'll send a sample and then send them a price list of what we have, and they'll just place the order all via email.
And what do you use to coordinate all these steps? Is that just Woodpecker or is there something else that you use?
We are using HubSpot. We're not fully utilizing it well enough yet. We're gonna need a better system for keeping track of all of the main clients we're working with. But right now, it's a combination of Woodpecker and HubSpot.
And so, when you add people to a list of people, potential customers to a list, that's going into HubSpot.
It goes into there too. Yeah.
Wow. I always think of HubSpot as inbound marketing, but this is total outbound marketing. Number one, you're just using them as a CRM, the way that some people would use a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me close by asking you this question. This was on my mind a lot when I saw the notes on the pre-interview. we ask you the same thing we ask a lot of guests. Like, if you could teach something, what would it be? Because we want to know what's the thing that you're especially good at that we want to get that knowledge out in our audience so that people have, you know, some superpower, some business superpower because of listening to this interview. Here's the weird part. You said I would teach them board game strategy, like Monopoly, Risk, etc. Why board game strategy?
Yeah. I would add like Settlers of Catan.
That's a good game. My wife's mom loves to play it. When she comes, we play it. She's incredibly good, but it takes about an hour to learn how to play it.
It does. Yeah.
I've had Settlers of Catan game at my one or two at my house with past interviewees. I get it. Okay. Tell me more. Sorry.
But yeah, the reason for that is making decisions, expected value, and the risk reward. I think if you really boil down why people are successful or not, a lot of it comes back to their decision making. And if you make your decisions based on expected value, and in particular, evaluate expected value, make the decisions based on times where you have a positive expected value. If you do that consistently over time, you're going to most likely do pretty well.
Doing this in your head? I've got my brother, when he plays poker, he'll do the percentages in his head. You do that in your head?
I do. Yeah. Some of the time. I used to play a lot of online poker. So
as you went through online poker, as you go through Settlers of Catan, Monopoly, you're saying, what are the odds of this happening and that happening? And you do the math fast.
Yeah, or like if we take the Settlers of Catan example, a lot of people won't trade in cases where they get a very advantageous trade, but they have this one card that they want to hold on to because they need it for this next thing that they're going to do. But if they would accept the trade, they would get so much more value, and then they could leverage the value that they got, thing that they still need. So if they would look at it instead of look at the expected value side of things, I think they'd make a different decision. So I don't know if that made sense.
It does. And I think that means that you make better trades, but man, it must drive you crazy when someone has a trade that logically is so good for them, but they won't do it.
It's a little frustrating.
You know what I've learned with these games? One of the best things you could do is just spend about 20 minutes online doing a little bit of research about them. Like, it's not that hard to figure out in Monopoly these days. If you played it as long as I did growing up, you'd know which were the right spots to buy up. Not the ones that feel right, but the ones that keep turning up, that you keep landing on. Now, if you just spend 10, 20 minutes online, you could find all this out. You know exactly where you should be buying. Settlers of Catan 2, the first thing that you need to do is pick property that will then give you these assets at, depending on the dice roll. And you just have to know which ones you should pick up front. And I'm gonna tell you
exactly.
Right now, which ones do you go for? I'll tell you which ones I've read that actually make a ton of sense.
Well, it depends on how the numbers are distributed on the board.
Right.
If you do a random, but for the most part, I'm looking for sixes. And I want to be on as many of those as possible.
Sixes
if
and
I
what?
Can pick sixes and eights.
Sixes and eights, right?
I prefer to be on one of each, 1-6 and 1-8, for diversification. And then if I can pick which resource, I like to be on ore, because that allows you to build cities and then you get at twice the rate of a settlement.
So I prefer, tell me if I'm wrong. I thought that the best place to be is, obviously you want those sixes and eights, because when you roll a six or eight, you end up getting a resource. I thought the better ones to get were wood and brick. Lumber and brick, because if you get lumber and brick, you could build a lot of roads. If you get lumber and brick, it means that you could get the ball rolling in the early part of the game, and you get to have whatever their equivalent is of houses. You know, the interesting.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what I should look up the statistical odds, but in my experience from the games I've played, when I get ore early on, you're able to build cities faster, and then you're getting resources at twice the rate of other people. Usually other people are going to want to build cities too, so you can leverage the ore to get your bricks and wood.
Because you're negotiating with them, you give them ore.
Exactly.
Which is harder to get.
So
you know what? I love that.
That's my approach.
I would love to play board games with entrepreneurs. Just let's sit down. We'll have a beer, not too much, because I want to do the math in my head anyway, and just play that. Forget skiing. I find that skiing is kind of fun with other people. I'm not much of a skier, but you don't get to talk when you're playing board games, especially with dudes. When I want to talk to guys, I can't just go out for drinks. We have a talk, but it ends up being in this hype cycle. If I want to have deeper conversations, I invite them over for poker. Inevitably, everyone will bust out and then we could just hang out. All right.
Yeah, for sure.
So we talked nothing about the one thing that you told our producer you'd like to bring up. I'm just going to bring it up at the end. I saw you were trying to figure out what that was. It's, he said, yeah. Hey, look, I'm teaching this stuff right now. If anyone wants to, I'd love for them to come to my site and sign up for my course. I'm going to tell them right now. Here's what it is. It's onlineselling experiment.com, singular, right? Onlineselling experiment.com.
Yep.
When they go there, they could read up about some of your experiments. At this point, it's plural. You got the Shopify store. You've got an experiment with Amazon. You used to list all of your revenue as you did it. You don't do that anymore. Why don't you do that? Why don't you list your monthly Amazon revenue?
Yeah, I don't do that for three main reasons. The one is we don't necessarily want our suppliers knowing exactly how much money we're making on the products. I don't necessarily want all of the family and friends that I have knowing exactly how much money the business makes. And then it also creates some interesting dynamics with members of my team when they see exactly what the business makes on a regular basis. So I felt like during the months that I did that and shared, it was for about the first 2 years I did the site, I felt like that I kind of proved that selling on Amazon was a viable replacement for the accounting job and that it kind of achieved that goal. So I decided to discontinue those posts for those reasons.
All right. It's still a really well done site because those old case studies are up, because I like the way that you think about your business and I like seeing you go through it. I will say the one negative is it is cryptic. I think there's a reason why you don't say it all, but I go, oh, I want to know more, man. How much, like, tell me that. Tell me this. But you do a good job of being useful despite that. Like, you're not holding back and saying, if you want to know all the tools that I use, give me your email address. You're just listing them and giving people links directly to them. You're not saying, I'm trying something new in e-commerce. You're saying, here, look, I'm trying Shopify. Here's what's working. Frankly, the numbers are pretty low on the Shopify experiment, but let me tell you how it happened. And I think it's an interesting read. Anyone who wants to check it out should go to onlineselling experiment.com. Your copywriter is phenomenal. And of course, if you want to take it to the next level with them, somewhere on here, I don't even know where the frick it is, but somewhere on here, he also has a course that you can sign up for, and a membership and books and other stuff. But there's a lot of good free stuff on there too. All right. I'm glad that you were on here. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you to the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first is, do you remember the two sponsors?
TopTal and ActiveCampaign.
Wow. All right. I'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Ryan. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome. Bye. Bye, everyone.